IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of All Things Policy. So today I have with me Priyal, and we will be talking about the concept of gastrodiplomacy. So gastrodiplomacy is basically a term to describe a new effort by the government of Thailand to promote Thai cuisine across the globe. So gastrodiplomacy is becoming an increasingly popular cultural diplomacy tool, and it's being used by states to promote nation building and nation branding. And it was the first attempt by Thailand at a state-sponsored food promotion campaign, which is, according to scholars, winning the hearts and minds through stomachs. So to talk more about this, I have with me Priyal. So welcome, Priyal, to this episode.
Hi, thank you.
So Priyal, can you tell us a little bit more about why gastrodiplomacy has become a new and effective tool in bolstering soft power diplomacy among states?
Amira, like, as we all know, cuisine ends up being a very integral part of nation's culture and identity, right? Yeah. As it captures like the essence of the history, the traditions and values. So it sort of becomes like a very effective tool in connecting people among various cultures. Now, sometimes it might seem like a nation's cuisine is being promoted to the foreign audiences. The gastrodiplomacy might seem like a very outward-looking practice, but we have to see that it has like a strong domestic component to it. One, because the government ends up playing a huge role in promoting the culinary heritage as part of like a public diplomacy abroad, as well as like the states will have to convince the private actors and citizens within the country to understand the value of gastrodiplomacy, as well as like a notion of unified national cuisine. Now, in the age of globalization, cuisine represents historic identities and associations between food, the places, and people also at like various levels, be it the national, international, regional, as well as like the local levels. And because of which, cuisine ends up being a unifying factor that sort of reflects the nostalgia of a country for its past, as well as the attempts of the government at building an identity in the present. And sometimes what might happen is it might seem like the national cuisine might be seen as a dividing force, because there could be a way that they might look at it as promoting just one image of an authentic cuisine. But gastrodiplomacy can still evoke a sense of national pride and unity around food. Now, if I were to give you an example, the global Hanshik campaign of South Korea intentionally portrays Korean cuisine in a very nostalgic as well as a selective light. And it reminds Koreans of a time before industrialization and modernity. And sort of like promoting the Korean cuisine abroad is a reflection of the promotion of a constructed Korean identity at home. And another point also I need to put across is gastrodiplomacy benefits a nation's domestic economy, especially its tourism industry, because so prospective tourists are exposed to other national cuisines and other nations' cuisine at like restaurants in their home countries. And depending on their dining experience, it can sort of like foster a positive association between the cuisine and the culture it represents, and sort of drives the consumer's desire to visit those places. And if you see these tourism websites of Thailand, South Korea, Taiwan, etc., they all feature very easy to navigate information about food tours and food information. Also, like, since gastrodiplomacy focuses on building a nature's image through the spreading of its cuisine, it sort of fits under the broader notion of cultural diplomacy, which is exchange of cultural exchange among like different nations and people in order to promote a better understanding of one another's similarities and differences. And gastro diplomacy sort of fulfills this purpose because people in all countries can relate to a cuisine, even though cuisines may vary from place to place. Like, for example, for a person in America, for an American audience, a Korean food might seem very foreign, but the gastro diplomacy can lead the foreigners to develop an appreciation of it when they learn about it. So, and another thing is also that this developing a national as well as cultural brand allows the nation to empower its ethnic as well as diasporic communities abroad who help in fulfilling this gastro diplomacy objectives or unite around a shared national cuisine. So engaging diasporic communities and national cuisine abroad also contributes to the economic growth as restaurants and chefs abroad will purchase very specific ingredients for their dishes.
That's very interesting. And I think it's also something that's very unique to the field of international relations and soft power diplomacy to have something like, you know, gastro diplomacy as an essential tool which has just come about now. And you've made that clear with also the example of South Korea. And let's go back to Thailand now. So when I spoke about in the beginning of this episode, I mentioned that, you know, Thailand was one of the first countries to essentially start this gastro diplomacy campaign. And it is one of the earliest and most successful examples of the campaign due to its successful promotion of its cuisine abroad from the early 2000s till now. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Thailand's gastro diplomacy began in early 2001, I believe, as part of the Thai government's effort to brand Thailand as the kitchen to the world and the food basket of Asia. And, you know, under the name of the Global Thai Campaign, this campaign was just one of the multiple projects related to food and fashion and health and culture. And it projected a positive image of Thailand abroad and it drew attention away from negative stereotypes. So can you maybe elaborate to us more on how this campaign was executed and how it reached the point of success that it did?
Right. Like you mentioned, the reason I think was to sort of like take the attention away from the negative stereotypes associated with Thailand and stuff. And so the Thai gastro diplomacy was implemented in multiple ways. And one thing that has remained very constant is Thai government's involvement in it. So be it from conceptualizing and even enforcing its campaign abroad, Thai government has played a huge role. And multiple groups in Thailand were involved in implementation, like Export Promotion Bureau, Ministry of Commerce, Media and Advertising Organizations, as well as the Finance and Education Support. So what they did was first they created something called as the Thai Select. And what this does is they certify the overseas Thai restaurants as authentic and of high quality based on criterias and based on like multiple inspections and criteria, such as if they're open for at least a year, if they're operating for at least 5 days a week and being certified by Visa or American Express credit card companies, employing Thai chefs with Thai cooking backgrounds, using materials and equipments from Thailand, and offering at least 6 Thai dishes on the menu. And these standards sort of reveal the government priorities regarding the Thai restaurants to be, one, to be operational, second, to be accessible, as well as to be convenient for the foreign audience who may prefer to use credit card payments. And having Thai in its employee demographics, educational backgrounds, methods, and food offerings. So this gives the Thai government more control over the image and the quality that the restaurants abroad are projecting. And it also ensures that the restaurants receiving the government funding and the loans also align with the image of Thailand that the government is hoping to project. So also, it also helps to promote a standardization and consistency across the Thai restaurants. Another method that that was used by Thailand was to promote its food abroad that is by training the Thai chefs to work abroad. And it has been supported by special visa arrangements with other countries. So chefs could get work visas. Like, for example, New Zealand has a special visa issued specifically to the chefs from Thailand to promote Thai food. And it's called as the Thai Chef's Work Visa. And this visa allows the Thai citizens who are qualified, experienced Thai chefs to work in New Zealand for up to 3 years. And they are also eligible for an extension of 1 year. So the also the efforts by the Thai government to facilitate the training and sending chefs abroad has not only allowed the Thai citizens to experience other culture, but it has also provided opportunities for those who may have received culinary training from government programs to go abroad and spread the Thai cuisine.
That's really interesting, Priyal. And I think it's so fascinating how Thailand has even, you know, started this campaign and got traction towards its culture in such an innovative and creative way. And I think, you know, the love for Asian cuisine is something that is common for everyone, for a lot of people. So there should be more countries coming out and having campaigns like this and as an attractive gesture towards their regions. But I mean, of course, it's not going to happen everywhere. But were there any outcomes that came about from the execution of this campaign? Like, were there any definitive outcomes that came about? Were there any changes that happened after in terms of Thailand's diplomacy relations in general?
Yeah, right. So after, I think overall, Thailand's gastro diplomacy campaign is considered as is highly regarded for its ability to increase the number of Thai restaurants abroad from around 5,500 in 2001 to almost 13,000 in 2008. And it is considered in overall, Thailand's gastro diplomacy campaign is considered as one of the most successful ones. Also the increased presence of Thai food and culture abroad can provide a good cultural experience for foreigners and increase the tourists' intentions to visit or like revisit Thailand. Also, through the interactions between tourists and restaurant owners, Thai restaurants position themselves as, you know, teaching spaces for to teach Thai culture and treat customers in a very polite, friendly manner. And this has sort of increased the customer satisfaction towards the Thailand and Thai food. And even though the Thailand's gastro diplomacy started somewhere in 2001, it is continued to, like, it's still considered a priority to this day. And currently, I think in 2016 or something, they went through a whole revamp of the campaign. And currently, they are emphasizing the need to boost food exports and like get Thai food products up to like international safety and hygiene standards, as well as to continue supporting Thai restaurants abroad. And earlier, the previous gastro diplomacy in Thailand, majority of those efforts mentioned, they were surrounded around the United States or the Western European countries. But nowadays, they are focusing more on countries such as Brazil, Japan, the United Arab Emirates, and Poland. And the current activities sort of like suggest that the Thai government is trying to broaden as well as deepen the scope of its gastro diplomacy campaign beyond the Western countries and restaurants to other nations.
And like, I think, you know, apart from Thailand, like the other major country to get into this campaign is South Korea. So, of course, like after being inspired by the success of Thailand and other gastro diplomacy campaigns, South Korea officially announced the Global Hunsik campaign. Am I pronouncing it right? I don't know. But Global Hunsik campaign.
I think Hunsik. It's okay.
Sorry. Okay. Priyal is the expert on Korean culture. So thanks for that. But so they announced this campaign at the 2008 Korean Food Expo. And the objective of this was to promote Korean food as a leading ethnic cuisine in the world by 2017. So in 2009, steps were taken to implement it, and 36 members from the government and academia and food industry executives, including the former first lady, took part in this. So very, very similar to Thailand, South Korea's gastro diplomacy campaign was an intra-governmental effort. But some of the key ministries were the Ministry of Agriculture, Forestry, Fisheries, Ministry of Culture, Sports and Tourism, who were all involved in this. So is there any, do you see any difference between the campaign implemented in South Korea and Thailand? And in terms of execution of the two campaigns, what do you see as a major difference between the two? Or if you see the similarities, then what do you, did they have the similar objectives? Did they achieve the same results?
Yeah, so basically the global handshake campaign, which was implemented by the South Korean government, was very similar to that of Thailand. And like Thailand's campaign, it focused more on the health aspects of the national cuisine. But a defining characteristic of Korean gastro diplomacy was that it capitalized on the growing popularity of the Hallyu wave, which is the Korean wave. And this Korean wave was responsible for the mass spread of Korean pop culture, music, film, TV across the world. And it sort of enhanced the enhanced South Korea's image as this global culture producer and exporter. And around the same time that as the gastro diplomacy campaign, the South Korean government was investing heavily in building up and exporting K-pop. So the global handshake campaign is sort of an addition to the broader Korean wave that can benefit from the growing awareness of the Korean culture as a result of K-pop. In fact, I think they also sort of like had these movies and television shows that increasingly focused on like the Korean food, or even when a Korean idol would have certain food or Korean food or something, they advertised it heavily. So they sort of depended or heavily built up on that whole K-pop as well as the Hallyu wave culture.
Okay, so on that note, I think that investment in gastro diplomacy efforts in Asian countries has really revealed the value that nations place on its cuisine, especially as a part of its domestic national identity, and as well as the representation of self that is promoted to the international community. So the only thing is that as these campaigns require large amounts of money and resources, governments also must adjust their strategies and implementations. And if they are held accountable by their domestic public or market forces abroad. And gastro diplomacy represents an increasingly important aspect of cultural diplomacy that states are still learning how to utilize. So before I end this episode, we'll be taking a break now, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Okay, so we are back, and thanks, Priyal, for talking to us about South Korea. So before we end, I just want to say that investment in gastro diplomacy efforts in Asian countries reveals that the value that nations place on its cuisine as a part of its domestic national identity, as well as a representation of self, is promoted to the international community. And the problem is also that these campaigns require large amounts of money and resources, and governments must adjust their strategies and implementations. And, you know, gastro diplomacy represents an increasingly important aspect of cultural diplomacy that states are learning to still utilize. So Priyal, on that note, I want to end by asking you one last question of whether you find gastro diplomacy to be a fun, new, effective tool in promoting diplomacy, or is this just, you know, something purely out of attraction for one's cuisine and it's not really helping in nation building and building relationships between two states? And how do you view the future of gastro diplomacy after looking at the successes it's had in Thailand and South Korea? And should states be indulging in campaigns like this?
Right. So clearly, with respect to, if I go purely by the way Thailand has implemented it, they do see success. And obviously, over the past nearly 18 years or so, nearly 20 years, gastrodiplomacy has continued to be a way to for them to sort of exert their cultural diplomacy. In fact, multiple other countries, like we've discussed before, South Korea had followed that path. Taiwan has followed that path. But South Korea and Taiwan did end up having sort of like shortcomings in their own way. Because one thing we need to understand when we come about gastrodiplomacy is that it involves a lot of very socio-political dynamics that are involved, because you're involving the public, you're involving the government, a lot of multiple factors because they are involved. The chances of failure is also very high. And we can see that with multiple other, we can see that when with the way South Korea failed in its first installment of the Global Handshake campaign, where due to the political controversy and corruption charges against like the South Korean politicians and business conglomerates, the public sort of lost faith in the whole process. And they ended up having to, they couldn't defend their, you know, the way they spent that money that was budgeted for the gastrodiplomacy there. So there are chances that this could fail, but this is also one of the methods I think middle income countries sort of exert or show their power. It's sort of like a soft power, right? Like we discussed. So if we see it purely in terms of like the Thailand's perspective, a very good planning and execution could potentially lead to like a successful campaign. And if we think about India, if we were to talk about India, India does have like high potential for, something for gastrodiplomacy, given the cuisines that we have, given the diversity that we have. So all in all, I would say that this could be a very good tool, but there needs to be proper planning and there needs to be proper execution in order to go ahead with this.
Thanks, Priyal. That was a really interesting episode to record with you. And thanks for joining me and sharing your thoughts on this topic and bringing it to the spotlight. So thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Amira. Thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle, @TakshashilaInst, or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.